For those of you who don't know me, and those of you who do, my name is Paul. I'm one of the elders here at REC. Great to be able to share with you. Really grateful for the time that we have. And as Ian's alluded to earlier on, we're going to be thinking a little bit about leadership today. Leadership, but it's in a context. So when I was thinking, how do I introduce sort of what we're talking about today? I was thinking earlier on this week, it's like, oh, brilliant. We've got a new prime minister, or we're going to have a new prime minister. That kind of lends itself really easily to talking about leadership and authority and all those kind of things. And I kind of was thinking, oh, let's get pictures of Andy, but no, I can't do that. But let's start thinking about what leadership for the country might look like. But actually, this isn't about leadership for the country. What we're thinking about today in terms of our time in 2 Corinthians, this is about not what makes a good leader for the United Kingdom, it's what makes a good leader for the Christian church. What makes a good Christian leader? You see, the context of what Paul, who was the one of the people who started up this church in Corinth, was going through was that he was having, if you like, a challenge from the people in the Corinthian church about his style of leadership. It seems that there's some other people who started to come in whilst he's been away from Corinth, and they seem a bit more appealing than Paul himself was. And so I've been thinking, well, what's the picture? What is, if you like, the image that I really want us to go away with at the end of today, or at least understand the whole of this passage from? And so it's a picture of the church, picture of what goes on in church. It might be a bit of a surprise, but this is it. I don't know if you can make that out. Anybody on the front row kind of share what it is? You could, if you need be, you can turn around and have a look at that one over there. It's even closer to you guys over there. Anyone get a sense of what's going on in this picture? They are like army people. Absolutely. They are like army people. Now, if you've got a Bible with you, then it'd be really helpful if you keep that open for us. Because what I want to show you is that what Paul is talking about in this passage, and I think actually what the rest of the Bible also agrees with, is that there is a war going on. A spiritual war that we are in the middle of. So have a look at chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians, verses 3 to 6. It says this: "For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And we will be ready to punish every act of disobedience once your obedience is complete." You see, what we've got going on is a war for obedience. A war for obedience. And the way we experience this war and the way we fight in this war and the way Paul is talking about it in these verses, did you see the words he uses? We demolish arguments with the knowledge of God. We take captive thoughts so they become obedient. They punish acts of disobedience. You see, this is a war that he is talking about. And so what you have there is you have somebody who is in the middle instructing and preparing the troops for that war, for that battle, so they know what it is that they need to do. But the question is, what's the mission? Where's this battle heading towards? Well, the mission is all about obedience to God. This is the battle that's going on. Have a look at chapter 11, verse 2. This shares with us where the end result is, if you like. Chapter 11, verse 2, Paul says, "I promised you to one husband, to Christ, that I may present you as a pure virgin to him. You see, that's the end, if you like. It's the mission for the troops is to get to the end of the battle and be pure and blameless before God himself. That is the picture of the church. That's how I want us to be thinking today, because actually this is what I've found to be super helpful this week. So we are in this war, but what does it look like? Well, it's a spiritual war, which is, I guess, where we're surrounded by arguments and thoughts that oppose the knowledge of God. Worldly ways of thinking. Ways that seep into our hearts and our minds and become a way of living that is actually disobedient to God. It's a war which has been going on since the start of humanity. Later on, we'll be thinking that it was just the same in the Garden of Eden. So there's a war out there. But actually, chapter 11, verses 13 to 15 tells us something more. Have a look. It tells us that there are servants of Satan masquerading as servants of God. In other words, yes, there are the obvious enemies. The obvious people that might stop us from being able to complete this mission. But there's some double agents. There's some spies, if you like. There's some people that you don't recognize who masquerade as servants of God, even though they are servants of Satan. They are fighting against us. Dangers abound out there, but inside the church as well. And so this is why this picture is a picture of church. Coming to church is like being prepared to go into battle. It's about receiving orders, about being aware and warned of the dangers that face us in this operation. I want to say this isn't just unique to church, though. I think this is what Christian parenting is like as well. I think that's exactly what, as Christian parents, many of us are doing on a daily basis with our children. Our role is to prepare them for the battle that they are about to experience and that they do experience all the time. I think it's the same for life group leaders. I think it's the same in all sorts of areas where we have that authority or that leadership of younger Christians who are looking up to us. This is the picture for us to have. So, if that's a picture of church, who are the kind of leaders that we need? What do we need from the person in the middle there? Do we need someone with great military might? Do we need a brilliant communicator? Do we need a strategist? What kind of leaders do the church need? What kind of leaders does REC need? Well, we've got three things up there on the screen. First thing is this: Christ-like candor, then Christ commendation, and then Christ-centered clarity. I was so impressed myself. Do you know, I'm useless at this whole kind of getting everything starting with the same letter, but I not only did I get all of them like at the start starting with a C, but they're all C words. It's amazing. I'm so proud. And I didn't even use like ChatGPT or anything like that. I was very pleased. So yes, but try and remember beyond that. Try and remember what it is that we're thinking about here, which is the first, which is Christ-like candor. And this is verses 1 to 11 of chapter 10. You'll be aware from Rachel reading earlier on that this is quite a long passage and there's a lot to cover. So we're not going to go into detail in everything, but we're trying to pick out, if you like, those main sections. And it's so important, in particular in today, I would say, but so important. Actually, what you're doing is you're looking and seeing that I'm not just making it up. Because if all this is saying we don't just need a good communicator who can entertain you, then that is the last thing I want to be doing. Let's check out what God is saying in his word. Look at the things that Paul talks about, or that perhaps the accusations are about Paul in chapter 10, verses 1 to 11. In verse 1, he says this, "I, Paul, who am timid when face to face with you, but bold towards you when I'm away." Or verse 11, some are saying, "His letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he's unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing." You get a sense, if you like, that Paul's a little bit upset by what people are saying about him. Sort of implying almost that he's one person in one place and one person in another. But he says, actually, the problem that you've got is that you're not thinking through the right lens. You're not thinking with the right picture in mind. Because have a look at this. Verse 7, he says, "You are judging by appearances." In verse 2, he talks about people living by the standards of this world. In other words, what they're doing is they are looking at life and church through the same lens as everybody else, the lens of the world. They are looking at it and thinking through and comparing it to what they would see outside. They're looking on the outside. They're not looking at it in context. You see, what these people in Corinth wanted was they wanted someone who was charismatic. They wanted someone who tells them what they want to hear, so that it's nice to go to church. They want someone who gives them great, rousing speeches that keeps them entertained for at least 25 minutes. But let's come back to that picture. How useful is it if that person in the middle is brilliant at telling jokes? How useful is it to people going into battle if they can win an argument? How useful is it if they just come away going, "Yeah, that was nice"? How useful is it if they're sat there thinking, "Will we be home in time for the kickoff?" I don't think you think people would, in that situation, are worried about what's going on in the World Cup. Because the stakes are that high. It's so important. And so who do you need in the middle to give those instructions? What we need is we need someone who's able to speak into our situations, to help us to understand what is going on and to help us to know how we fit into that, to know what to do and how to do it. Now, there's a model which has come out recently, a model for leadership and leaders, which has been really popular in my workplace. The model's up there on the screen. It was popularized by an author called Kim Scott, and it's called Radical Candor. Has anyone come across Radical Candor before? I can see there's, two or three people, Radical Candor. And the point is this, okay, there are, if you like, two axes as far as Radical Candor is concerned. On the sideways one, you've got, how keen are they to challenge us directly? To tell us, if you like, the truth about how we're doing. So in leadership in work in particular, that's basically seen as, how keen am I to tell people in my team that they've not done the right thing? But there's another axis on about them sort of personally, so that actually there's a relational context there for them to understand what's going on and why you're saying what you do it, what you're saying. You see, that's the context, if you like, for the communication. Is there a context of care? Are leaders for us? Now, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you just to think about, on those two axes, the people around you. Would you like them? Where do you want them to be in how they relate to you? Okay, so do you want them, if you like, and I should have put numbers on these boxes, but would you like them to not really challenge you, but be nice to you? That's the top left. Would you like them to be nice to you, but really don't care about you? Bottom left. Would you like them to be really nasty to you and tell you that you're rubbish? Bottom right. Or would you like them to tell you where you need to improve, but also in a way that's caring for you? Have a think. Where do you want them to be? Top right. Top right. Okay, that is the right answer as far as Kim Scott is concerned. Radical candor. Top right. That's where, if you like, you get told the things that are a bit difficult, but you know the reason why you're being told those things is because that'll really help you to grow. Whereas if, for example, and if I'm honest, I'm probably a bit more like this at work. I'm nice to people, but at times I don't really tell them when they've not done the thing that they need to, because I like to be liked. I'm probably in that top left box a bit too much as far as leadership at work is concerned. That is called ruinous empathy. I am a ruinous empath in my workplace, which is not ideal, but I'm trying to work my way to be a little bit more challenging. But you see, when we look at something like that, what we want is we want someone who's going to help shape us to understand what it is that we need to do to improve, but also to do it in a way that cares. Now, the reason why I said earlier on that this was popularized by Kim Scott is that there is nothing new to this particular model. I mean, she's sold a huge number of books that about three people in this room have read, or at least heard about. But it's leadership theory is just really simple and straightforward, because if we rephrase challenge directly, let's call it speak the truth. And if you were to rephrase care personally and call it love, then what have we got in that top right-hand corner? We've got speak the truth with love. And my mind goes back to a story that is told of Jesus in the New Testament, when he met a woman caught in adultery. The religious leaders at the time were picking up stones to stone her. They were absolutely sort of hell-bent, if you like, on the truth. But they didn't care about her. They were in the bottom right box, if you like, which is I didn't even write down that what that is. I think it's something aggression. You see, they were wanting to condemn her. But what does Jesus say? He says, go and sin no more. He instructs her to change, doesn't he? He doesn't want her to go away the same, but he does it in a loving way. He points to the issue with absolute tenderness. You see, good leaders are like Jesus. It's not found in a book that you might read. It's exemplified in a man. Good Christian leaders have Christ-like candor. And that is what Paul points to as well in his own ministry. Have a look at verse 1 of chapter 10. Paul says this, by the humility and gentleness of Christ. Verse 8, he talks about boasting freely about the authority the Lord gave us for building you up. And verse 9, he's really worried, isn't he? He's worried. I don't want you to seem to be trying to frighten you. He's worried that they might think he's just frightening them. But Paul is unashamed in what he says to the Corinthians. Verses 5 and 6 are clear. Just take a look at them again. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And we will be ready to punish every act of disobedience. Paul's telling them what the enemy's plans are. He's identifying areas where they're vulnerable. And he's ensuring obedience to Christ. So friends, when we come to church, this is what we need. This is what we need. We need to recognize the battle we're in. We need to hear the truth spoken with love so that we go away and can make and can take every thought and make it obedient to Christ. Obedient to Christ, not our sinful nature that battles within us. So a few questions just before we move on. Do you feel like you're in a battle? Do you realize that that is what's happening? Is it hard for you to be obedient to Jesus all the time? I think it should be. It is. I think if it's not, then the chances are you're probably not realizing. It should be. Your mission is obedience under God. That's why we don't need to be entertained. That's why we need to be in church with church leaders who speak with Christ's truth, with Christ's love, with Christ-like candor to prepare us for the battle in our hearts and minds. Secondly, authentic Christian leaders need Christ's commendation. I'm going to blitz through this bit. I'm afraid if there's stuff that you want to ask me, fair enough, please do. But it's in verses 12 to 18. So there we've got our man in the middle, sharing orders. He's explaining the setting of the battle, what the mission is. But the question is, what authority have they got? What right have they got to stand there and speak to others? Now, at this point, I'm kind of looking in particular to the back because credentials are really important. And I wonder what your mind goes to when you hear the phrase supply teacher. Any thoughts? Esther Lear, any thoughts about supply teachers? Do you love supply teachers? Why do you like them so much? Oh, you don't do anything. You don't do anything. You see, I think back to when I occasionally did cover lessons when I was a teacher. I was a geography teacher. There was one lesson in particular, a music lesson that I was covering. I like to think that the kids put their hands up before they asked me this stream of questions. But basically, it was, first of all, why are you teaching us? Secondly, aren't you a geography teacher? Then, do you know anything about music? Then, can we go on the keyboards? Followed by, what is the actual point in this? You see, leaders and people who are giving instructions need to have some level of authority, don't they? They need to know what it is they're talking about. If you've got a music lesson, then you need a music teacher in order to be able to learn music. There's something about the person that has authority with credentials that gives them authority, and so we listen. So take a look at what we're looking for somebody in this sense, who to listen to. There are some repeated ideas about false teachers. Verse 12, it was really well read by by you here, Rachel, because verse 12 can be a bit confusing, but there's one word that keeps on cropping up. We do not dare to classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves when they measured themselves by themselves and compared themselves with themselves. They are not wise. Do you get the repeated idea? It's all about them, isn't it? All they're interested in is themselves and their credentials and what they do or they have done. You see, in contrast, Paul's not comparing himself. Paul recognizes that his role is from God. His role is for the churches that he's planted, the churches he leads. So in verse 15, he said that his hope is that as your faith continues to grow, our sphere of activity among you will greatly expand so that we can preach the gospel in regions beyond you. You see, he is the one whom God has approved and commended. I was trying to think a little bit about what this might look like, and I think actually the final section will help us on this. But don't you get the sense that those false ministers are thinking more about their ministry than God's ministry? They're probably, if you like, they have a CV of success, of churches that they've led, which have grown And look at what we've done. Look at what I've done. Look at what I've achieved. And they're taking credit for it. They aren't humble, which is what Paul is. Because when Paul talks about boasting, he only talks about boasting in the Lord, in what the Lord has done. The true servant of God doesn't take credit for God's work. Instead, the true servant follows orders and represents Christ. They don't build up a ministry for their name or their fame or their reputation. I am always suspicious of somebody that has a website that is their name, like a Christian leader that is sort of such and such a person ministries. I'm like, yeah, I can try and see what you're doing, but actually I'm suspicious now. Because it's about Christ, isn't it? No Christian preacher should become rich off preaching the gospel. A leader commended by Christ is humble, reliant, and always pointing to Christ. So listen to them. Which is our final point. Christ-centered clarity. This is what chapter 11 is all about. Again, haven't got time to go into all of it, I'm afraid. But we come back to this idea of our battle and our war. And as we said before, Paul outlines the mission in verse 2. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. And what Paul's doing there is he's looking really far forward. Forward to the end of time. Listen to what it says in Revelation chapter 19. It says this. Then I heard what sounded like a great multitude, like the roar of rushing waters, like a loud peal of thunder, shouting, Hallelujah! For the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and be glad and give him the glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come and the bride has made herself ready. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given her to wear. Fine linen stands for the righteous acts of God's holy people. See, that is what Paul, if you like, is aiming for. That day in the future when their mission is over and they are pure and blameless. And that is our mission here and now for us. To be ready for that final day when Jesus returns or calls us home, that we might be pure and blameless on that day. But in the meantime, there's a battle. And that battle is a battle for truth. Have a look at verse 3. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. In the Garden of Eden, Eve became convinced by the serpent that obedience to God wasn't important. She was convinced that she could decide what was right or wrong. She didn't think there'd be consequences for going against God's word. Adam went along too. But here's the issue. Being disobedient to God doesn't start with the action. It doesn't start with doing the thing that was disobedient. Instead, it begins with the heart. What we want deep down, what our greatest cravings are. And then what we do is we listen to the people that promise to give us those things. I don't know what those things are, if you like, for you, the deep cravings of your heart. Could be security. And so what you end up doing is you fixate on finance or insurance or whatever. It may be acceptance, and so you fixate on people who can talk about how you can improve your appearance. Maybe it's love, so you idolize relationships. I don't know what it is for you, but I suspect your social media reels would be a good place to find out. Because I reckon that most of the time your algorithm knows you better than you know yourself. Because they know what you look at. They know what you spend time on. What does your social media tell you about you? About what you want? You see, for Eve in the Garden of Eden, she wanted to be like God. She'd seen him in all his power and his beauty and his majesty as he walked in the garden with them. And Satan, disguised as a serpent, offered her exactly that. You can be like God if you trust me. She wanted it. He offered it. She listened to him, but he lied. My algorithm, he says, is all about exercises to get fit. I think they know that I've had an injury recently, and so all I'm shown are these things that I still can't actually do at the moment. That and cricket bats, weirdly. What does this tell me? I suspect it tells me that I'm craving to be young again. Craving to feel youthful. And I can spot that in social media. I think that we know there's a danger of the world out there being drawn away from Christ. Because we know there's all these voices out there, people clamoring for attention. That's the obvious danger. But do you see the danger? It's even harder to spot in verse 4. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the spirit you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. Then verses 13 to 15. Such people are false apostles, deceitful workers masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then if his servants also masquerade as servants of righteousness. Do you see what's going on in the church in Corinth? Satan's secret agents are calling themselves super apostles. They're getting into church and they're looking to spread fake news. And Paul's worried about this. Why? Because he knows just how dangerous fake news is. Because that's been the pattern of Satan's behavior since creation. Satan no longer appears, though, as a serpent. He has servants who are deceitful. They look like apostles of Christ. They look like church leaders, but they are sent to disrupt and deceive and lead you astray. And they do it with lies. Verse 4, they preach a different Jesus. They give a different spirit. They preach a different gospel. And the tragedy is that the Corinthians are putting up with it. They aren't challenging it. So you see how dangerous this is? Someone is coming into the church and using Christian language to talk about Jesus, the Spirit, and the gospel, but what they're saying is different to what these people have heard from the start. I don't know exactly what it was that they were saying, but it was probably something along the lines of the Christians in Corinth getting something and everything that they want through something in the world or through them themselves. Focused on them, not Jesus. So you want financial security? They'll probably say, give money to me and you'll be secure. You'll be rich. You want to be healed? Come to my ministry and experience healing. They're probably really charismatic, yet highly manipulative. I do think sometimes when it comes to this, that there's a danger with our modern, if you like, Christian internet, for want of a better way of putting it. There's so many people out there who are on YouTube or have blogs or podcasts or whatever, who are using Christian language, but we don't know anything about them. I think we just need to be really careful. Who is it we're listening to? Because actually, the people that God has given us are the people here in this room. We just need to be really careful because it's really difficult at times to spot a fake. How do you spot a fake? Last year, £4 million of banknotes were discovered in England that were counterfeit. £4 million. It's actually less than I thought. I thought it'd be more than that. But apparently, we're getting better at finding them. And so people aren't doing it as much. Either that, or they're getting much better at making them, and we're not spotting them. But either way, £4 million worth of fake banknotes. Now, how do you spot a fake? Do you learn every single possible permutation and trick that they've ever used in the past? And go, well, they used that one, so I'm looking out for no silver strip or whatever. No, you don't. You'd have to learn everything then. Instead, what you do is you learn the truth. So the best kind of people to identify forfeit notes are those who know the perfect note, inside out, back to front, upside down. They know the reality, they know the authentic, and so then they can spot whatever is inauthentic. And I think it's exactly the same when it comes to Christian teaching. How do you spot fake news? You spot fake news when you know the truth. When you know the gospel which has been given and handed down from the start. If you hear something that doesn't quite fit with everything you have known to be true, then please challenge it. Whether that's me, that's Ian, Ben, whoever it is, Elliot, challenge us. If you don't think it's right, ask us. Because that's important, isn't it? We need to know that we have that Christ-centered clarity at the heart of our instructions as we head out into the battle. So, security, acceptance, love, those belonging, those are some of the things that deep down we might be desperately craving in our heart. And we've looked to satisfy those things in all sorts of places. We fixate on them and can never find that lasting peace. Don't know if that's you today. But we were designed to experience those longings because we're designed to find them in Christ himself, in God himself. Looking elsewhere is a symptom of our ongoing denial of him. We're like rebellious kids refusing to listen to our loving parents. But God spoke and broke into a world of rebellion in his son Jesus. He experienced the punishment that we deserve for our sin by experiencing death. He was a substitute that made forgiveness possible, but he rose to new life, demonstrating that he'd broken the power of sin and death, and he invites us to turn away from that old, empty way of living and live for him. He gives us a spirit which means that we belong in his family. You see, the Lord Jesus is the answer to all of our longings. He gives us security. We cannot be snatched from his hand. He accepts us and restores us to be part of God's family. He loves us more perfectly than we could ever imagine being loved. And so our part in this is to turn from chasing after those other good things that God has given us, to turn from those things that will not satisfy and turn from to God himself in Jesus. This is our battle. Our daily battle. But he gives us his spirit to help us. And so we come back to where we started. We're in a war, a battle for our hearts and minds to be obedient to God in Christ. What we need are a church with leaders to prepare us for that battle. Leaders who know us and will challenge us and will care for us. We need a church with leaders who will focus on Christ and not themselves for their own gain, committed to the church in their care. We need a church with leaders who will always speak the truth about Jesus, clearly, openly, and honestly, because bottom line, we all need Jesus. He is the one. He is the one that the person in the middle always needs to point to.